I'm pretty sure Darth Vader's point of no return was killing younglings, but maybe that's just me. I don't know.
I mean, he did blow up like an entire planet, so.
At least one planet that we know of.
Probably a lot of younglings on that one, too. Live from the Mundangerous Desecrated Temple in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 187 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about losing yourself to the Siren Song of Evil. But first, the Rogue Traders finally gain an audience with a powerful rival in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Purifier cleans up your mess in the Character Creation Forge. So Shane, do you watch Stranger Things?
I do watch Stranger Things. Have you heard about the latest episode of Stranger Things that's coming out?
The latest episode? In real life?
Yeah, it's not on Netflix. It's in a box. It's published by Hasbro.
It's going to be in our minds.
So, yeah, so cool thing, Wizards of the Coast announced recently that there is now a D&D Stranger Things starter box, which is sort of geared towards running the adventure with the Demogorgon that the kids in Stranger Things were running in the basement sort of at the beginning of the series.
Okay, so I had heard some rumors about this. So it is the version of the game that they are playing, not a version of the game in which you play the kids from Stranger Things, right?
Correct, yes. You are okay. Playing the dungeon with the Demogorgon in it, not playing the kids from Stranger Things.
Although, I mean, you could use it to play the kids from Stranger Things who are playing the dungeon.
That would be pretty meta. Yeah. So in the box is like the adventure book, a rule book. There are pre-made character sheets. You get dice, though I will note it's 6 dice. You don't get 2d10s. And then there's also 2 figures. There's the Demogorgon and then an unpainted Demogorgon, which I guess is interesting.
Is it interesting that it's unpainted?
I mean, it makes me think there's 2 Demogorgons in the adventure, right?
It's paints a bull, though. Yes, we're pretty sure.
Yeah, so there's a painted one and a paintable figure.
Okay.
I guess everything is paintable if you try hard enough.
So you played Magic the Gathering back in the day, right?
Like uh-huh.
A bit. Okay. Long, long ago, there was this card called Scheherazade, where
yes.
You would play it targeting another player, and the two of you would like go off and play another separate Magic the Gathering game, and whoever won that, like I think, you know, or whoever lost that lost a bunch of health, right? And then you come back to the original game and pick up where you left off. Hear me out. What if you play Kids on Bikes, which is that like, you know, simple RPG where you were essentially playing like Stranger Things,
right?
And then within that, then you use this to play a D&D game of the game that they were playing.
Oh, that's meta.
Super meta. Scheherazade was banned from Magic Gathering tournaments because it
was way too long. Yeah.
No, it was like the worst idea. So I don't know. Maybe it's not a great idea.
It's like the only good card in Arabian Nights, and yet.
All right. So the Stranger Things starter box is going to be available at most major retailers nationwide, pretty much everywhere you can get, you know, all this like D&D swag.
No. It's not D&D. It's actually published by Hasbro. Like they have a Hasbro logo.
Oh, so it'll be like
box.
everywhere.
So it's like everywhere. Yeah, it's going to be in the like the Hasbro games aisle instead of being in like the hobby retailers.
Oh man, you can find it at Toys R Us. Nope, not Toys R Us. Barnes & Noble. Nope, may not be around when April swings by. So
probably
we'll
find it at Target.
KB Toys. Nope. Okay.
Okay. All right. It's a bad industry. It's a struggling industry.
All right. Yeah. It looks like it'll be $25. Of course, as you note here, Shane, you can get the actual 5e starter set for less than $10.
Yeah. So if you don't care about the Stranger Things branding, you can get started with D&D for under $10 just using the traditional adventure.
Yeah. Or the basic rules PDF for free online.
I think this is actually pretty cool, though, right? Like we've seen like a crossover of Magic into D&D. Now we're seeing D&D like first put on sort of the big screen, right? But at least in a pretty big hit of a series, and now like it's actually going to be on store shelves everywhere. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I agree here. I think maybe it was like 6 months ago or so, we complained on the air that like Wizards of the Coast doesn't do a very good job of marketing, especially these crossover things that they should be taking advantage of, because like the zeitgeist is all D&D right now. Yeah, good on them for actually doing this.
Yeah, it only took 2 years, but you know, that's good. You got to get the rights, I guess.
It was just in time for season 8.
Right.
It's great for the direct-to-video movie, which I really actually hope comes out on VHS, you know.
Exactly.
Maybe Laserdisc. All right, speaking of making good decisions, here is a message from DM's Deep Dive with Mike Shea.
Hey, it's your pal Mike Shea from the website Sly Flourish and author of the books The Lazy Dungeon Master and Sly Flourish's Fantastic Locations. I'm going to be hosting a brand new show on the Don't Split the Podcast network called the DM's Deep Dive. Each month, I'll be talking to a member of the D&D community about a particular topic of the game like encounter design, tools for improvisation, and game pacing. You can subscribe to the show through iTunes, on Twitch, or on YouTube. Join me and we'll all work together to make our games fantastic.
All right, we're back. Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And on the Deathworld Iblis Prime, in the frontier city of Meridian, the Rogue Traders have set out to establish a colony in the name of the Holy Throne of Terra and Prophet. And while your mining camp is being held together by an increasingly frantic Trank, your Heretic Doc continues his research, and Trix is uncovering embezzlement.
Now hold on here, okay? In Trank's defense, the reason he is increasingly frantic is because of Doc.
Well, because of Doc, and because
there's a causal effect.
Everyone else is leaving the camp to go do other things, and you're like, wait, I gotta keep this together by myself and watch Doc? Are you people crazy?
I'm trying not to shoot him in the head, but he gives me every reason to.
You keep telling me not to kill him, and yet here we are. So meanwhile, Flair is in Meridian moving forward with his plan to contact the Sentinels, which are like the security organization in Meridian. They're kind of one of the powerful factions of the city.
So Flair does as Flair does. He is, of course, a noble, even if he's sort of on the outs with his house. So he proceeds as he always does. He simply approaches the Sentinels' compound, has one of his lackeys rap on the door, and requests an audience with the person in charge, the patrician.
Yeah, so this goes exactly as well as it deserves, and he is literally laughed off the premises.
I like that, like, Angelo knew this wouldn't work. But,
oh, yeah, like, but he had to.
Yes, of course, Flair had to do this. It literally would not occur to Flair not to do this.
And it's like just one more embarrassment that poor Flair has to suffer in front of his own, like, his own attendants, right? His own Felipes.
His current Felipes, yeah. All right, but he does then go out and enlist the help of Trix, who's actually pretty good at this bureaucratic stuff.
Yeah, he is at least skilled in dealing, you know, with the non-noble castes of society. So they do what Trix does, which is begin gathering dirt and employing some sort of minor irritation intimidation tactics, right? They start asking around town about certain people. They start posting up in like known Sentinel haunts, you know, different bars and taverns and gathering places that Sentinels like to be in. And they just kind of like are there, you know, they don't make a scene or anything, but they're just present. They're just sort of that nagging question that everybody in the organization is going to start asking.
Eventually, they're enough of a nuisance that they do get called in for a meeting. But it's not with the patrician. Instead, it's the Sentinel's spy master, the librarian.
Yeah, so they meet in a very public place, actually. Like, right in the center of Meridian in sort of the noble compound where, you know, it is, you know, the rest of Meridian, pretty Wild West, you know? There's the occasional shootout in the streets, the occasional brawl, riot, you know, gangers running street races and that sort of thing. Not all that uncommon. But here in, like, the nobles' quarter, it would be pretty untoward to, like, even really show a weapon, right? Because here, if you're here, you're rich enough, you don't even need to show that kind of blunt power. So they meet at a cafe, and they get kind of jerked around a bit by the librarian, right? Like, she has somebody sit with them at their table and start speaking to them, sort of the usual nothings of spycraft. And then she does the move where from the table behind them, she starts speaking to them, you know, just kind of the classic thing, just a subtle reminder that Flair is not good at this.
An overt reminder that Flair is not good at this.
Well, it's subtle in the sense that they haven't, you know, just like packed his seat with explosives and set off the detonator, which was actually mostly Flair's concern, was that he would just be ambushed.
I wish that had happened. I think that probably the funniest part, if that had happened, would have been that the entire room would explode and the one most likely to survive would have been Flair.
Yeah. So the librarian basically kind of levels with them. She says, you know, like, she has been rather amused by them fumbling about town trying to seek the audience that they have been. But, you know, for all their lack of capability there, like all of their lack of spycraft, she does at least appreciate that you're recognizing the power of the Sentinels, right? Like, you have at least acknowledged that they are a group that you need to be on terms with, whether good or bad, like, they are there. So she does kind of, you know, give you a begrudging respect, even if you're not actually good at playing her game.
Unfortunately, it's immediately squandered because Trix and Flair basically beg to have an alliance.
Yeah, it was... They're like, we know about your debts and we wiped them, and also, like, we know where you hang out and stuff. Could you be our friends, please? yes. The proper application of alcohol can undermine everybody's abilities.
So they do settle for her promise that she's not going to oppose them when we actually, hopefully, begin to succeed in making a name for ourselves.
Yeah, you're almost certainly going to ruffle feathers if you continue to be successful in your mining operations. And she basically says, hey, look, like, we're not going to get involved. We're cool. We're not friends, but we're cool.
And then she asks them to stop doing favors for the Sentinels.
Yeah, so if you recall, Flair's original attempt here was to... try and collect information about them and some leverage on them based on some debts that they were kept with a bookkeeper, with one of the bookies for the Digilords. And in the process, Flair murdered the guy and then wiped all the Sentinels' debts with his lieutenant in order to save face. And yeah, the librarian is like, look, that was actually a really good source of information for us, and it was well worth paying a few coins out and losing bets in order to have that source of information. Like, please don't step in any more of our stuff.
Hey, good. All right. That was a nice bit of information that we got from that, right? Right? So it's a win. It's a win.
Yeah. Can
we go with a win?
Let's call it a win. We're going to call it a win.
And we'll find out what happens next week. So this week, Shane, we are talking about corruption. What is it?
Okay, so it's not abuse of power and accepting bribery and all the usual political corruption type things. We're here talking about, as Webster calls it, a departure from the original or from what is pure and correct.
Oh my God, have we strayed into book report territory?
Oh, we're doing book report territory like, here.
According to the dictionary.
Because what I don't want to talk about very, very clearly is like government corruption and politics. This is about personal corruption.
Right, and we're also not talking about like... you know, things decaying or rotting in nature, like the blighter that we did not too long ago.
Right. Yeah. We're talking about more of like a moral decay or a personality decay or, you know, the decay of the artifice of the world around us.
All right. So what does it mean, though, in an RPG?
Yeah. So in RPGs, it typically means like the gradual transformation of a player character into something that is evil or otherwise impure. Right.
And this is usually occurring when the player doesn't really want that, right?
Usually. Yeah, typically, right? I mean, there is the downward slide of an arc for like alignment, of course. That would be more along just a series of the player's choices. But I think a lot of games treat corruption as like a gotcha, right? It's a penalty that you pay as a result of doing certain things.
Yeah, so depending on the game, it could have just role-playing consequences, you know, people trust you less or you're developing a bad reputation. I mean, it could even be something supernatural, like you begin to smell like brimstone, or it could also have actual mechanical effects, like with your dice.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some themes that show up in RPGs when we're talking about corruption?
So I think the most obvious one is the fall from grace, right? And this is like a super old Judeo-Christian theme, like dating back to like Paradise Lost and even like the Garden of Eden to a degree, is the idea that like you have something, you are good, you are noble, you are pure, and you will eventually descend into evil and madness and, you know, just awful.
Yeah. You see this certainly in, I guess, more quote-unquote recent stories. The holy champion who's failing to live up to their own code, they fall short and they either, like, wholly give themselves over to evil and become a blackguard, or, you know, maybe they just have fallen short and you know, are unable to redeem themselves, like a Lancelot figure.
Yeah, or they've fallen short and they just become a fighter.
Right, yeah, and now I just don't have spells. Yay. Right. And I didn't even get extra bonus feats.
Yeah. I mean, this happens for a lot of like religiously themed characters, right? I think by nature, that's the way D&D has been written, where if you're not upholding the tenets of your deity or of your, you know, temple or order or faith or whatever it is, like you can cease to be able to use those powers.
Mm-hmm.
This is also kind of the theme of the Horus Heresy in Warhammer 40K, like the whole idea of the emperor being betrayed by his son Horus, who has fallen to the chaos gods, and sort of like given all of the angelic iconography of the Imperium, you know, it's like it's very close to Paradise Lost. Like it is the angels rebelling against heaven and being cast out.
Yeah, this is, I mean, common with almost all of these narratives. Like, if someone was not good, then the betrayal doesn't actually mean anything. So, like, the arc must have begun, like, on the high end before swinging down low.
Right.
And the reason for this is often some sort of moral failing, right? These stories exist to sort of, like, relay lessons about how real people should actually live. There is something wrong about the way a character like views the world or about the decisions that they make that leads to their downfall.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that these particular characters need to start as good or as pure as some of these like Paladin to Blackguard transitions or like, you know, Lancelot falling. Anybody, no matter how good or sort of like normal or average they are, can still make a bad decision or like deal with some sort of like level of hubris or fatal flaw that causes them to like fall even further.
Yeah, and this also comes in when you have like more of like absolute evil in your setting, right? Like the idea that you could be an evil character who is still redeemable, right? But at a certain point, like you have become so corrupted by evil that you're no longer capable of redemption, right? Like the Emperor and Darth Vader, for example, right? Like there's no redeeming Emperor Palpatine. Like he just has to go.
I mean, we talked about this in Crossing the Moral Event Horizon, that episode. I'm pretty sure Darth Vader's like point of no return was killing younglings, but maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Okay, but again, that was retconned. OT only. I mean, he did blow up like an entire planet.
Yeah,
so.
at least one planet that we know of.
It's like probably a lot of younglings on that one too. the other thing though is like that fall from grace doesn't necessarily have to be because of a moral failing, right? It can also be from like just a flaw of character, right? Like there are plenty of there's plenty of characters who grow corrupt not because they're like giving over to temptation or moral failure. It's because they're foolish, right? Or they're not suspicious enough, or they're like too trusting of somebody who is betraying them, right? Like you do have those kind of like tragic falls from grace where, and I mean, that's actually like the, going back to the Horus Heresy, like that's what happens to Magnus, the Primarch of the Thousand Sons, is like he kind of has no choice, right? Like, he tries to do the right thing to warn the Emperor of what's happening, and then he gets cast out, and he has no choice. Like, he falls to chaos because he trusts his brother. Like, that sucks.
Yeah, this sort of separates it from religious stories, which typically teach that as long as you're trying to do the right thing and you try very, very hard, then, like, you'll be all right. But the much more, I guess I would say, realistic stories, sometimes you do everything right and you still fall because, right, like, life is a pendulum that swings between tragedy and absurdity. Oh, wait, are we talking about games? Sorry, we're talking about RPGs.
But life in RPGs is a pendulum.
So one of the, I think, important aspects of corruption is that it almost always comes with some sort of gain or power. Like, in RPGs specifically, but, like, in stories as well, like, you get something from leaning toward the dark side. Like, you get to use Force Lightning, mm-hmm, right? Like, you are powered by rage, which is a much easier emotion to tap into than a lot of the, like, whatever emotions Jedi are supposed to tap into. I don't actually know. I don't know, harmony, I guess. Yeah, you
tap into balance.
Yeah, that's a primordial feeling that is welling up inside me when bad things happen.
I mean, I wake up and I just feel so balanced.
Yeah. In a lot of games, you know, as you slide toward corruption or toward evil, you become more powerful. Like, if you actually do become a Blackguard in D&D, like in 3.5, you gained a bevy of additional abilities. Even in 5e, actually, if you look at the Oathbreaker Paladin in the Dungeon Master's Guide, it's, like, considered pretty strong, and I think we don't even use it in the character creation forge because it's, like, it's overly strong.
Yeah, so to come back to the theme around that, right? Like, a lot of times what drives the corruption itself is lusting after that power or lusting after that immortality, right? It's the desire to harness those abilities. That's where you get, like you said, you know, dark side Jedi do that, but also, like, in fantasy you have, like, liches and vampires, right? A lot of times they're seeking out, like, ultimate arcane power, right? Immortality, or vampires are seeking to stave off death. Like, that's the sort of romantic tragedy of the vampire, right? Is the, like, the vampire, or the person who becomes a vampire and then makes their true love a vampire so they can live on forever in on life.
But now things just aren't the same. I don't know. You're looking a little peaked.
Yeah, something's a bit off.
Huh. You get this with mad scientists in Deadlands. They don't necessarily understand what the heck is going on. They don't get that, like, the souls of the damned are in the coal that they're using.
Right, yeah, the ghost rock.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're, you know, they are just trying to advance scientific processes as much as they can, like, to push the boundaries. Although, like, this happens a lot. Like, you know, something's weird and wrong. Like, it feels like you probably shouldn't be doing this, but there's nothing specifically saying that it's a bad idea. And so that then becomes sort of like, maybe you're failing, but also the thing that causes your fall is you just weren't questioning enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that the mad scientists, I think, in Deadlands tend to be more of the, like, background or setting, or, like, a lot of times, like, they're the NPCs that are putting into motion, like, the plot of a Deadlands adventure, more so than the characters, because, like, Deadlands doesn't spend a whole lot of time in labs, right? But it does spend a whole lot of times dealing with, you know, a mad scientist who's created this monstrosity and has lost his mind in the process.
Yeah, look, it's Jurassic Park, okay? They spent so long wondering if they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Right. So a lot of settings also treat just magicians in this way in general, right? Like, certainly historically, if you treat witchcraft as real, right? Like, witches were exiled and persecuted, but
yes,
like,
exiled into this bonfire.
I mean, again, pretending that witches were real.
Okay.
But, you know, like, lots of low fantasy settings aren't comfortable with magic, right? So anybody who uses magic is maybe believed to be demonic or possessed or something like that, like, that sort of fear. Certainly that's a theme in 40K for psykers who aren't trained, or in, like, Warhammer Fantasy for the same.
Hmm. And then lastly, the one of the other big themes that you can tap when you're dealing with corruption in your game is the character that is succumbing to temptation, who like very legitimately, like out in the open, knows this is a bad thing, because in fact someone is saying, hey, you should do this bad thing because it will be great if you do it. You know, back to the Garden of Eden, like the snake says, you know, God said don't do this. I know God said don't do this, but you know what? It'll make you pretty smart.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty great if you do it, though. So this is also a big theme of Call of Cthulhu, right? Like, and there's a layer of dramatic irony laid on top of Call of Cthulhu where, like, as a player, of course, you know that your character should not be investigating that strange Necronomicon in the library, right? But as characters, like, you are driven to do that, right? And you know that the knowledge that you gain therein is going to ultimately be your undoing, because you, like, you don't want to pierce the veil of the Elder Gods, right?
Yeah, I think my favorite application of this in games is the, to be honest, the relative trope of an actual devil, a fiend, showing up and, like, tempting a mortal, you know? You have Faust. Like
the Faustian bargain.
Yeah, exactly. I think in the abstract, a lot of times, you know, players will say, that doesn't make any sense. Like, who would ever trust a devil? Like, you know they're going to screw you over. You know they're going to steal your soul. But, like, in practice, in the game, when presented with potentially maybe you feel like you could outsmart this devil or at least get away with it, and, like, the parameters of this contract actually seem pretty reasonable, a lot of players
it's
go
like
for
you're
it.
Talking right at me.
You're right here.
Because my character in Morning Glory in our Eberron game, Brand, lost a hand and then made a bargain with our devil in order to have him act as my hand.
So did you think that, like, were you worried at all that you might, like, Brand might lose his soul?
No. I thought I had pretty secure safeguards around that.
You felt you had, like, locked down the language of the contract?
I felt pretty good about that, yeah.
All right.
I had bigger concerns around losing control of, like, my appendage, and less so about, like, losing my soul, but more around, like, being compelled to do something that I didn't want to do.
And it was balanced out by, like,
the fact that I was completely nerfed and incapable of pursuing our much bigger objectives,
which is save the world.
Right.
Okay.
it was exigent circumstances that led to Brand's corruption.
look, that's how it happens, right? I just wanted to save the world.
Exactly.
And instead you lost yourself.
Sometimes you're just a noble idiot.
Although, let's be honest, if it were flipped around and they refused to, like, save the world to protect their own soul, wouldn't you be like, wow, that's really selfish of you?
Yeah, Brand would, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So does that put Bastion's betrayal at the end of Morning Glory, when he was literally tempted by a fiend, does that put that into perspective? Do you have a different perspective of his betrayal of the party now?
No, because the cost was... because he was prioritizing, like, a minority of souls over all souls.
Yeah, but if you had all joined up, you could have had a majority of souls. 60%.
Okay, we don't have to rehash this argument every time we talk about it. But yes, the theme of temptation can also lead to personal betrayal, as Bastion demonstrated in the Eberron game.
Yes, the theme of temptation. Like, if you watch Temptation Island, you're a bad person. Deserve to fail.
And you are personally betraying your parents, who raised you better than that.
And yes, we said we weren't going to talk about it, but this happens with political corruption as well. An obvious theme is, like, political bribery, leading to a downfall, either loss of office or loss of reputation.
Yeah, and I mean, this is one of those things, like, it might not, it's certainly not our focus of this episode, right? But it fits along those themes in, like, more realistic, kind of more grounded games, right? Like, even, like, I'm thinking, like, Knights Black Agents, right? Like, you're a spy, primarily, but you do work within, like, a bureaucracy, like a government bureaucracy, right? And you do engage with, like, different arms of government and, like, sort of pseudo-government agencies. So, like, there's a strong theme of corruption around that. That could certainly filter down to a Knight's Black Agent character, right? And then I think the last theme, right, we've talked about a couple different ways, is sort of the fool, right? So the the Faustian character who thinks like this is a good deal, and genuinely believes that like this is the right thing to do for them, and they are obviously in over their head. Or, you know, as you mentioned, Brand is sort of in the same boat, right? Like he was corrupted by the fact that he thought he could control the outcome of his bargain with the devil.
What? I traded my eternal soul for being very good at the violin for 7 years. Who's the fool? Come on.
Or in the sequel, The Devil Went Down to Georgia, he actually turned out on okay, right? Johnny wins.
Well, you know, everything's turned upside down in Georgia.
Right. Sure.
Nothing happens the way it's supposed to happen.
This is also Eisenhorn, the Inquisitor in 40K, does the same thing, right? Like, he ends up corrupting himself eternally in order, like, seeking power through binding a demon.
To help people.
Yeah, I mean, to continue working for the best interests of the Imperium, just very radically and probably at the cost of his own soul.
All right, so let's talk about corruption mechanics in your game.
Yeah, so this is kind of one of those principles that we always espouse, right? Is like the mechanical weight that you give over to a theme should reinforce its importance. So if corruption is the core theme of the genre, then the game probably should have robust mechanics, right? Like it should really feature that as a part of the game. And if it's secondary, then it might be relegated to more like role-playing cues or sort of how you treat the character in fiction rather than having, you know, affecting your dice rolls and being necessarily like constructed on your character sheet.
Yeah, like if you're playing a Mort d'Arthur game, Lancelot and his fall is probably going to be a big part of the game, or like it'll be somewhere in the mechanics. But it'll be especially important if there is like a corruption track that you're sort of tracking exactly how far Lancelot has fallen.
Right.
Or like if Galahad is like right behind him.
Right. And that doesn't necessarily mean that like the impact of corruption on the game and on the story can't be huge. It just means it's not sort of like core to what the game is designed to create. Right.
Right. It's like necessary but not sufficient. Like if there's a number on your sheet that says how corrupt you are, then it will need to be referenced.
Right, right. So what are some ways that we can have these mechanics showing up in games?
So you can have different character traits or aspects or keywords depending on the specific mechanics of the game that you're playing.
Yeah, I think this works best in systems that are more broad or designed for kind of generic games. So I'm thinking like Fate, or GURPS, right, where you end up with long lists of aspects and traits that describe your character, and each have like their own mechanical impact for how they're used in the game, right? So your character might gain just a trait that's called corrupted or lust for power, right? Like those are just descriptors that then have a mechanical impact on your character.
Right, and that you're either referencing when you are taking actions or resolving outcomes. Or that you're just leaning on for like to inform your roleplay.
Yeah.
And because they're mechanical, they often have both a positive and a negative impact on your character. Or if they're solely negative, then they probably need some additional positive trait to offset having it. Like, and you know, that might be like you get extra build points, or you get to pick a positive trait as well.
Right. Or they're linked, right? Like,
right.
Like aspects and fate are both things that can be like used and compelled against you, right? So like being corrupted is almost certainly often a bad thing that you are going to be like compelled to do things because you've been corrupted. But you could also maybe lean on your corruption for more power in certain situations.
Yeah, and having the effects packaged together is probably more common in traditional fantasy. Like if you're a wizard who turns himself into a lich, you're very obviously corrupted. Mm-hmm. But with that comes a great deal of additional power of being undead and, you know, an infinite amount of time in order to do research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like when you talk about like packaging effects, you can get like a wholesale swap of class or archetype or like templates applied to your character as a result, right? Like I think the like lich or vampire were both like modifiers that you could just build off of your character, right? They just changed your CR in your SR in third edition?
No, it was still CR. But yeah, it was like a coat that you would put on a character, right?
EL, right?
Oh,
when
yeah.
It was on the PC? It was your effective level. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that just got subbed into your character, right? Or I think actually Lich probably had a prestige class, I'm sure, at some point.
That was 4th edition probably. Had Lich. 3rd edition had a template that you applied. Mm. So you could like make anything a Lich.
Yeah. Same thing with a Fallen Paladin, right? Like in AD&D, Fallen Paladins were called Fighters. And like later on they became Oathbreakers or Blackguards or, you know, various variety of like empowered negative Paladins.
Yeah, so on the back end of these transformations, they usually sort of happen wholesale, right? Like you turn into a Lich and now the ritual is complete. You fall as a Blackguard and now here's a new character sheet, right? It's a good opportunity to really sort of bring that home, to tie together the mechanics and the storytelling. Like you're working with the player or your GM to determine exactly what point the fall occurs or like the corruption becomes total. Mm-hmm. And then we reflect that in the mechanics by basically redrawing an entire sheet or like retconning very large aspects of a character.
Yeah, so to just contrast that to like just adding character traits, right? Like you can wade into the pool of filthy miasma, right? And like when you do that, you gain the trait corrupted. Like that's just what happens, right? And you just write it on your sheet and we move on and you can find out what that means later. Like you can't really do that for a Lich, right? Because the moment that you become a Lich, you've, you know, finished your ritual or like gotten the last bit of knowledge or whatever it is, like you have to transform into a Lich, not just in the story, but also like your whole sheet gets wiped away, right? Like there's like a rebuild component, like that just there's more mechanics around it. So you need to build that into your story pace so that there's actually time to incorporate that. Because otherwise, like if you start the session or like, you know, an hour into your session, like one of your players becomes a Lich. All right, well, they're going to spend the rest of the session making their character a Lich, like actually filling out the sheet and like finding all the different abilities and like figuring out how their character works. So you're going to kind of screw up the session if you do that midway through.
Yeah, like if you are having the deep and emotional conversation about the Paladin falling to become a Blackguard, the pivotal moment should be at the end of the session. And like everyone's going to gravitate toward that anyway, right? Because
well,
like
hopefully.
45 minutes before the end of the session is like not the optimal time for it to happen.
Nor is it the very beginning. like the 5 minutes before the session. Hey man, you're going to be a Blackguard in about 20 minutes. Are you ready?
do I have to re-roll hit dice? Yeah. Yeah, you do.
Yeah. All of them. and then I think we've alluded to it a couple times, but I think a very common one that we see in games that are really prioritizing corruption as a like an ongoing long-term theme for basically all characters is when you see either a corruption or an insanity like damage track, right? They kind of treat it as another pool of hit points that can eventually either kill your character or otherwise take them out of play.
Yeah, we talked about this in the episode on insanity, but corruption basically does the same thing. You gain more and more until, voila, you're an NPC.
Mm-hmm. So usually when you have these kind of damage tracks, there's some mechanic with which to resist them, right? You have some type of defense against them or like a saving throw or something similar before you actually like, you know, some attempt to resist. And then you also typically find it like much easier to gain your corruption and more difficult for you to heal your corruption or possibly even just impossible to reduce that track.
Yeah, you get this in a lot of Star Wars games where you have like a dark side track or like dark side monitor on like how much dark side you are, right? And there's always like a fulcrum point at which you sort of flop over and now mm-hmm. now you're dark side and either you're going to be a Sith and maybe you can play a Sith in the game or like now the GM is running your character.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that like I remember in Saga Edition what would happen is it was relatively easy to gain dark side points and very difficult to get rid of them until you became a Jedi Master. And a Jedi Master could get rid of one dark side point like per round.
Oh.
Because like the whole point was they would dip into the dark side and then like redeem, dip in and redeem. And that's one of the reasons that they were so powerful.
That's a weird, that's a cool mechanic that is very weird in the fiction.
It works for Mace Windu.
Okay.
But great. Probably less Yoda.
like the old purple lightsaber. Got it.
Yeah, exactly.
So a lot of times this this damage track comes with other mechanical effects bolted onto it, right? So as you advance down the damage track, there are some further mechanical impacts to your character, right? That kind of like get added over time. So like typically these are going to be negative, right? It's just like if nothing else, sometimes it's just more difficult to heal or more difficult to resist as you get more and more corrupted. A lot of times your own defenses are undermined. But otherwise, like, you can end up with benefits and drawbacks that are just, you know, related solely to your corruption track.
Yeah, you might get tougher or stronger, either mentally or physically. Oftentimes, you gain access to new abilities or spells. You might just get straight up improvements to attributes or traits. You know, you gain new keywords, or you just get bonuses to ability scores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then almost invariably, the price of this is too high, right? Like, there are enough drawbacks to gaining this corruption that whatever, like, benefit you're getting, probably not worth it.
Yeah, I like when the mechanics mirror the temptation that the character is feeling by tempting the player, and this works really well when it's, like, a slippery slope. So, like, the first time you're a bit corrupted, you gain a small boost, and like it's not that difficult to resist, but then it subsequently becomes more difficult to resist, and the abilities that you gain grow exponentially as well. So you have the player sitting here going, okay, well, I could go three more steps in, and that's probably where I should stop, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. let me high point this.
Right, although then I only have a 30% chance of actually stopping.
But so I'm going to be real bad up to a certain point, and then I'm going to be really good.
Super good.
Super good.
I think this character is true neutral. That's what I think.
I mean, you're describing Doc. You know you're describing Doc in Dynasty Unwarranted, right?
Yep. He's like, corruption. I hurry up and wait.
Okay, yeah, I can. Excuse me while I optimize my corruption.
Look, if it has a number attached to it, you can.
So Dark Heresy has like kind of a fun thing where you roll randomly for the effects of corruption, and you have a chance to resist it every once in a while. But the negative effects are rolled randomly, and the table is pretty skewed towards either like inconvenient or outright negative. But there are some on there that are like, you know, your 5 or 10% chance of actually getting these things are really cool and really powerful, right? Like, and Doc himself has It Will Not Die. So he will eventually become a demon and he literally cannot die anymore. But he's paying for that with the price of his soul and the copious amounts of corruption that he continues to gain as a result.
Yes, he will eventually become a terrible person soul has been given over to evil.
He is a terrible person. He will become a terrible demon.
Okay. Works for me. All right. So now that you've nailed down the mechanics, what are some good ways to incorporate this into the roleplay at the table?
Yeah. So there's like a lot of cue questions, right? You want to keep in mind, like, what does the character know about their corruption? Right. And how does the character feel about that corruption if they know about it, right? Like the old adage, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. They might not know that they're bound for a downturn.
The road to hell is also paved with skulls, so I just feel like any basic insight check should let you know this is not a good idea. Oh no, those are the skulls of our enemies. And I think they might be research subjects who gave their bodies right to science. That's probably
exactly
what it is.
They check the box on their driver's license.
Yeah, they were paid. Yeah, I also really like the dramatic irony aspect of like the character maybe understanding something different from the player.
Yeah, this goes well with like Call of Cthulhu theme, right? Like the player knows that every pursuit of knowledge is terrible for the character, but the character has genuine curiosity and doesn't understand the effects that are going to come.
And then you need to decide, is the character resisting this corruption or are they embracing it? Are they actively pursuing it because of the benefits that they're going to gain? Either one is actually a really interesting storyline.
Yeah, so because if you're resisting, you want to figure out like what causes corruption, and then like how do you cure the corruption, and like you end up having to weigh every decision against the risk of further corruption, right? Like, so it becomes like kind of an ever-present problem that the character has to wrestle with.
Yeah, like in our Darksome game, we're like, okay, no defiling. That is horrible and corrupt, and once you start defiling, it's hard to stop defiling. We'll never do it. Until the point when we were like, okay, but what if we don't know about it and that person does it?
Yeah. What if you're mind controlled?
Right, is it fine then? It's okay then, right? Yeah, yeah. What if you tell everyone you were mind controlled?
And then the opposite, right? If you're embracing the corruption, like, are you hiding this from your companions, or are you openly acknowledging it, or maybe even flaunting it, right? Like, are you embracing the corruption to such a degree that, like, you don't think they can stop you?
And then you scream that, right? You cannot stop me! And then that makes it true.
That's, yes, that is exactly how it works. And they absolutely won't even try because they know that it's true.
I speak only the truth. Then the question is, can a character who is suffering from corruption overcome it, assuming that they want to?
So in some settings, this just might be categorically no, right? The setting of heaven in Paradise Lost, like there is no redemption for the fallen angels.
Or Lovecraft, like, you slowly become more and more insane. There's no, like, doctor to help you with that.
Right. In high fantasy or, like, more heroic genres, then redemption is usually possible, right? It might be really difficult. It might require a lot of sacrifice. But a character that is, like, determined to do it can accomplish it.
Right. It might require, like, heroic death in order to actually right. redeem yourself or yeah. your family line.
Like I said, it's hard. And then if they do manage to either like overcome it or at least stop it or, you know, reject it, like what does the character learn from that experience? Like how are they changed? How do they behave afterwards that's different?
Yeah, what is different about themselves? The way that they think about themselves, their reputation. This is a good opportunity. It's a good time to think about the kind of character who has fought corruption and has kind of won, who maybe has won a Pyrrhic victory against it in mm-hmm. that they are definitely like still scarred by it and affected by it and may still have some lingering negative effects, but do still get some benefits. Like Jim's replacement character for Draco in Dark Heresy is someone who was formerly possessed by a demon. Like that's the background. Mm-hmm. And like they get a bunch of negatives, but they also get a bunch of bonuses, and that's something that wouldn't necessarily have to happen when you create a character. Could happen in the middle of a character's arc, right? You do finally like break free of the demon's embrace, but you are left fundamentally changed by it.
Yeah, and I mean that also then tells you something about the people around you as well, right? Like for example, Jim's character bearing the marks of like demonic possession and still being welcomed into your crew tells you something about the crew, right? Like you are not as puritanical as maybe some others in the Imperium would be.
Yeah, we're genuinely pragmatic. We know that someone who has broken free of the possession of a demon once is actually much better at resisting it now, and so that's why he goes first.
Right. And likewise, it tells you something about like the broader world at large, right? How they respond to it. Like, how do people in some random backwater planet respond to Jim's character when they see the scarification that's a result?
Yeah, the open scarification, like outside his body, because often you'll have physical changes to your appearance. Palpatine, of course, like became an ugly dude because we just believe that people are more evil when they're ugly.
Right. He became a witch.
Yeah.
So yeah, you might find characters looking more gaunt or like constantly exhausted is one way that they're often described. Like they might be sallow. They might have like a jaundiced tone to their skin. Generally, corruption isn't associated with being a peak of health.
You know, you'll have like goat hooves or grow antlers or
crab claw hand.
This happened a lot with like the tiefling random characteristics table, right? Like that was inspired by like stories of people who are corrupted by dealings with devils. So mm-hmm. you smell a bit like brimstone, or you have a forked tail or a forked tongue.
Yeah. So all of these things are going to sort of beg the question then, how do NPCs, like how does everyone react to seeing this or being associated with somebody who has this?
Even after the mechanical effects are done, the role-playing effects still linger.
Do you hear that, Ishan?
Yes, I can hear everything because I have big, floppy, droopy ears now. It's a sign of my corruption by the demon lord of Basset Hounds. And so here we are.
Well, that can only mean one thing. It's time to move on to the character creation forge and roll up a Basset Hound demon. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
Hey, you. Yeah. You listening to the podcast. I bet you like tabletop role-playing games. That's probably why you're listening to a podcast on the Don't Split the Podcast Network. Well, did you know there's a show on this network called Tabletop Babble, where I, James Intricasso, talk to many industry greats and awesome people who play role-playing games about role-playing games. It is great. It's like any conversation you would have at your local friendly game store. I've talked to people like Mike Merles, one of the lead designers of 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, Wolfgang Bauer of Cobalt Press, Ruth Tillman, who's done a lot of awesome game design work with Pelgrane Press, and so many others. You can check it out over at DontSplitThePodcastNetwork.com.
And we're back. Can you imagine if instead of being hyena people, gnolls were Basset Hound people? I think nobody would be afraid of them until they, you know, got torn limb from limb and eaten alive.
Who's their demon? Yiganoth or something?
Yinogu.
Yinogu? Yeah, I bet Yinogu would be like way cooler with more people. He'd have lots more followers if he were a Basset Hound.
And he's a demon lord, right? Shouldn't he be able to like look like a Basset Hound?
No, absolutely not.
What if he put on a Basset Hound mask and pretended to solve crimes?
Okay.
But wait, still, his followers were like terrible, bloodthirsty savages. I still think it would work.
Is he wearing a trench coat?
Yes, and a deer stalker.
Okay, then yes. I mean, obviously, yes. An unreserved yes. I guess it has one reserve. Must be wearing a trench coat.
I must be too corrupted. I don't really see anything wrong with the human sacrifice.
Well, it's convenient because today in the Character Creation Forge, we're building the purifier.
Like a thing that goes on my tap?
A holy Brita filter.
Ah, wonderful. So tell us about the purifier. What does it do?
So the idea of the purifier is that when you are corrupted, when you have these negative qualities brought upon you, the purifier is here to get you back on your feet, heal you both mind, body, and soul, and more importantly, get you back in the fight.
All right, so Shane, what is the build?
The build is Oath of Redemption Paladin 14, Grave Cleric 6.
We talked, I think in the Xanathar's guide review, we talked about how like Oath of Redemption is really good. It is a very good paladin subclass.
Yeah, it's a good and fun one. Like it's good in a way that isn't undermining the rest of the party.
Yeah. So you get all the paladin goodies. You get to smite stuff. You have great auras that give you bonuses saving throws.
You get a steed.
Yeah, you get some channel divinity options. Emissary of Peace, which gives you +5 to persuasion. Hey, everyone, can't we all just get along?
Yeah, come on, guys.
And you can also Rebuke the Violent, which lets you redirect the damage from an attack.
At level 7, you'll get Aura of the Guardian, which lets you take the damage for an ally as a reaction. It's a great way to protect your spellcasters from making concentration checks, for example, if they have polymorphed you into something big and terrifying.
And at 14, you get Cleansing Touch, which lets you end a spell on yourself or a willing creature as an action.
Yeah, that's kind of your capstone ability, right? It's your way to remove sources of magical corruption.
I like that it is a willing creature because it means that you need to use that persuasion bonus to talk corrupted allies into wanting to be better, and mm-hmm. then you can help them. But like it doesn't sort of override their own character arc by saying, no, you're not corrupted anymore. I fixed it.
Yeah, so the reason I went with Grave Cleric and not Order Cleric is actually that. Because the Order Cleric does have the ability to charm, but I feel like removing corruption from a creature that isn't genuinely willing to give it up is not on theme for the Purifier.
Yeah, and I think like as a GM, I wouldn't let that actually remove corruption, right? Because the whole point is that it's about like your soul and about your choices. So like someone commanding you to be good doesn't make you like less terrible, and it certainly doesn't redeem your soul.
Yeah, exactly.
So from Grave Cleric, we get Circle of Mortality, which maxes healing for any creatures who drop to zero. You can sense undead with Eyes of the Grave. And of course, you get the amazing Path to the Grave, which lets you curse somebody, and that doubles the damage from the next attack that hits it.
Then at level 6, the reason we take Grave Cleric all the way to 6, you get the Sentinel at Death's Door ability. That means as a reaction, you can turn a crit against an ally into a normal hit.
So this character is really good at protecting allies, potentially from other allies.
Yeah, from other allies or from, you know, from perhaps the corrupting influence itself, you mm-hmm. know, like a vampire attack is going to be very hard to get through on your party if you're sitting there. So in terms of leveling order, I think you just want to start Grave Cleric, go all the way to 6, and then switch over to Paladin. It lets you get your Cleansing Touch ability as your capstone, which feels like a really thematic thing, especially because Cleansing Touch as an actual ability probably won't directly address corruption mechanically the way that you would expect, just because of the way that like D&D doesn't treat corruption as its own damage track. So, you know, it's more of a flavorful thing that is actually quite powerful, right? Just not specifically for the theme of the build.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ishin, who is your Purifier?
So my Purifier started off as the shepherd of a small congregation far away from like big towns. It was just, you know, a small farming community. She performed ceremonies and marriages and the occasional like bless or, you know, helping, you know, farmers like birthing calves until one fateful, terrible day when she dealt with a young child who was possessed by a minor demon, probably a Quasit or something that was, you know, escaped from some sort of wizard who had brought it on as a familiar, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she wasn't able to save that child. She didn't really know what she was dealing with, what she was up against, and realized that she never wanted to have this happen again, to have people, innocent, kind, good people, corrupted from within by things far beyond their ken. And so now here she is, making sure it doesn't happen to any of these adventurers in her party. What about your Purifier?
So my Purifier is comes from a region that is known to be run or controlled by vampire lords.
Mexico, right? Is that what that works?
I suppose. I don't know which edition you're playing, and I don't
isn't
particularly
that Rifts?
Care.
Isn't
Rifts.
Rifts, Mexico, run by vampires.
That totally makes sense in a very Kevin Symbieta way of like,
yeah,
you took Dia de los Muertos and made it vampire stuff, right? Anyway, so as a result, right, like there is like sort of an order of resistance, right? An order of the grave, which, you know, in one way is sort of serving the needs of the vampire lords by, you know, performing a lot of duties that are necessary to not only keep their herd of human cattle alive, but also like sort of the burial rites and everything necessary to create new vampires, right? Like there's a magical process there as well. But as a result, like my Purifier has grown to resist that. So gaining sort of the ability to protect others around them from becoming the prey of vampires, right? They're sort of resisting corruption of the vampiric embrace preemptively. Like sort of the best defense is a good offense, if you will.
I know that someday they're going to want to eat me, and so I prepare for that day.
It's almost like herd immunity in a vaccination, right? Like that's kind of what the Order of the Grave is about.
Well, vampirism causes autism.
Of course. I saw True Blood. I know these things. but then eventually my purifier isn't content to just defend against these overlords. Like my purifier is on the warpath, wants to directly go after them, and thus becomes takes up the righteous cause of a paladin.
Becomes Blade.
Basically becomes Blade.
Nice. I dig it.
All right, before we wrap up, let's take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
All right, what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're continuing our series on campaign settings, and we are, I guess, finally talking about Middle Earth.
I'm not familiar with that setting. Where is that located?
Is that a thing from Thor?
Where is that located again?
On your shelf, most definitely. Okay. You may not have read it.
Not my shelf. All right. In the Character Creation Forge?
We're building the Rider of Rohan.
All right. Well, that's it for episode 187 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you by our friends over at Kobold Press.
Want to learn the secrets of elven magic? Who doesn't? Even the elves do. That's why they're always turning into Balnorn and liches.
Yeah, they're just real slow because they live so dang long.
Oh man, right. I'm 114 and a freshman in college.
Yeah, but I got a way that you can condense that timeline. You can learn elven magic lickety-split.
Oh yeah. You can blast your enemies with battle magic or build cunning mechanical servants with clockwork magic using the Deep Magic series from Kobold Press, which has all this and more for 5th edition D&D.
You can learn time magic, rune magic, illumination. There's nearly 20 PDFs with new ones coming out all the time.
So in this series, you'll find new magic schools, sorcerer's origins, warlock patrons, feats, spells, magic items, and more. I think that covers the bases. That's pretty much everything.
All the big magic ones, yeah.
Best of all, each Deep Magic PDF is a deal. Most of them are just $2.99 for a huge trove of content.
Oh my god, I can't even deal.
$2.99 is not even $3.
That's less than a cup of coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, which I drink because I am a blue-collar, red-blooded American, sir.
Yes, wait, is it really? Is a cup of Dunkin' Donuts coffee more than $3? Because that is a ripoff. Dunkin' Donuts coffee should be 69 cents like McDonald's coffee. Also, it's just Dunkin' now. D-U-N-K-I-N apostrophe.
Hang on. If you're getting like the extra large like I am because you are fueled primarily by coffee, then yeah, you're going to spend like $3.50 on your coffee.
Oh, wow. Let me ask you this. Would you rather have in your hand a scaldingly hot, extra large, swill water coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, or would you like a Deep Magic PDF that lasts forever on your computer as long as the human race has electricity?
I reject the premise. I would like that PDF on my phone. And that's where I put it.
Well, if you're like Shane, you can pick up the Deep Magic series for 5th edition at www.koboldpress.com.
And we outie.
We should get Annie's for best podcast ads.